This continues with Scheuer.
The United States radio astronomy at that time was controlled by proper astronomers, to whom a telescope meant a paraboloid mirror, nothing else. And their contributions, also great, were of quite a different kind. The little world that I am talking about, which I understood after your synthesis and thought about it, consisted, I imagine, of the CSIRO Radio Physics Division in Sydney, the English radio astronomers in Cambridge and in Manchester, and I think the French group. Furthermore, the Manchester group at that time were very much preoccupied with building a very large paraboloid indeed, and so their interests were really elsewhere. The underlying principles were neatly written down by Bristol and Roberts in Australia. I wrote them down too, but only in my thesis, because Martin Ryle took a very severe line that in matters of engineering, one ought not to write me a theory, one ought to build the thing first. The thing I was particularly interested in was to get the so-called supergauge aerials into the formal treatment of in normal Fourier theory. Those break the rules about how much gain you're allowed to get from a given size of aerial, and I wanted to make sure that there wasn't something in this loophole from its spot. There wasn't. Well, it took 10 years, 1954 to 1964, to get from the full understanding of the principles to the first working example of a full-scale Earth rotation synthesis aerial that came to 1 mile telescope. I don't think that was because we couldn't make the next mental leap, as it were, from synthesis in the sense of something which worked transit and which you build up an aperture by gradually filling in all the spacings on the ground in the obvious manner, to using the rotation of the Earth. Pat O'Brien had been synthesizing pictures of the Sun by moving aerials along different baselines at different times of day, wheeling them around on carts. I've been observing the profile of the Milky Way when it's at a particular time of day when it formed a vertical arch over Cambridge, and we could look at it with an interferometer, two little aerials sitting on the ground. So the fact that the Earth turned the interferometer around had been forced into our consciousness quite enough. But, of course, not one, but several technologies that are taken for granted now just weren't up to the job at the time. The most obvious one is computing. Electronic digital computers were being developed. One of them was being developed in the Cambridge University Mathematical Laboratory by Maurice Wilks and his associates. But up to that time, in practice, we did our little Fouriers with the aid of Lipson Beaver scripts, little cardboard scripts, came in beautiful wooden boxes and were borrowed from the crystallography section. And these carried one cos nx and two cos nx in strips, one laid them neatly side by side, and they totted up columns. And that was how one did it. In fact, there was a great deal to be said at that time for doing all the Fourier analysis in the hardware. That is why, for a very long time, the Mills Cross was obviously a marvelous option, and many groups built the Mills Crosses. Now, rather less obvious than the computing difficulty, is perhaps, at this distance at any rate, are the many implications of the fact that there just were no low noise receivers at high frequencies, short wavelengths. At meter wavelengths, if you want an antenna of large gain, it is an enormous cumbersome thing, and it is not the sort of thing you really want to put on an equatorial mount and then trundle around on rails. It's hard enough to build standing rather firmly on the ground. On the contrary, if you go for a large number of small aerials, low gain each, then you run into a terrible difficulty that each of the primary beams will emit a little bit of radiation from the two monster sources in the northern hemisphere, Cassiopeia and Cygnus, which are 10,000 times brighter than the sort of level you might hope to reach. And I think the presence of Cassiopeia and Cygnus in the Northern Hemisphere may even account for some of the differences between the development of radio astronomy in the North and the South. They really were a great bugbear. Nowadays, one has good receivers of short wavelength, so one can build parabolic antennas, now, of course, they're quite large size, which have enormous forward gain, and Cygnus and Cassiopeia are no longer a great bother. And so many of the younger radio astronomers perhaps don't even realize much of the time that there is this problem. So we do have a euphemism for it. It's called the dynamic range problem. We have a dynamic range problem. One further comment I would make in the same vein. That I guess that one of the reasons for the great successes of the Owens Valley Observatory was John Bolton's confidence that he, that by the time his interferometer was complete, he would be able to build good receivers at the enormously high frequency of 960 megahertz, or megacycles. Well, through the latter half of the 50s, one finds in Martin Ryle's laboratory notebooks, still exist, any number of different aerial designs in Moldova. Most of them are for transit-type synthesis instruments. The first appreciable-sized two-dimensional aperture synthesized by research students called John Blythe. Could I have the first slide? He built a long line of 48 crosswire dipoles over a reflecting stream. And I will quote from his thesis: by judicious choice of the line of aerials to avoid huts, hedges, paths, a stream, telephone lines, and other aerials, it was found possible to construct an array 1,200 feet long. And in conjunction with this, he used a wonderful dipole over reflecting streams, I think on the second slide. Just one dipole over a reflecting screen, which he moved along a north-south line and so synthesized a two-dimensional aperture. And he made a map of the sky. Shown here, there's the galactic plane, of course. We have the next one, which shows the other half of the sky, and shows how awful the present Cygnus and Cassiopeia was, somehow the great abundance of the sky, where the reception of Cygnus and Cassiopeia through little cyclones is just too awful to allow one to do any job at all. He did use a computer for this, EDSAC-1, to do the Fourier calculations. And used it with some difficulty to reduce this mass of data. It was even greater difficulty later on. It only had a storage of 1,024 words to hold both the data and the program. So there had to be a good little shuffling around things. However, it worked. It was the forerunner of the system, the exact forerunner of a number of real working systems. The aerial that produced the 4C catalog, radio sources. Go to the next slide, please. Here it is under construction, parabolic cylinder, and the next, please. Here is the fixed long array, complete. I think the next one shows either the moving part. This here says there's the thing moves on north south rails, configuration. One long thing this way, and then not something synthesized pencil beam, but again an interferometer with a set of rails. There is, in fact, a set of rails at that end, along with this moving bar, moves north south. There's also a pencil beam version, exactly analogous to the Blythe instrument, at 38 megahertz. Next slide, please. Shows the fixed long line. And the next one, I think, shows the moving element. Yes, with. Somebody there anyway. This, of course, had to be carried around from one set of angle iron poles to another by an appreciable part of the star, holding the various bits and moving on to the next bit. Excuse me. These aerials, these new aerials, were built on the new science board bridge and the new observatory, which we were able to get using money given by the government and also by Mars. This event is due to be celebrated. Next slide, please. The dinner at Gondola and Keyes College. Next slide, please. Which I show here because one looks around, one can see the faces of a lot of people concerned. One can probably see rather more clearly any of the characters involved that are around on the photograph I brought with me and on the slide. Okay. Well, on to Earth synthesis, Earth rotation synthesis. The first written mention of Earth rotation synthesis, as opposed to a jocular mention that there might have been in conversation, on the basis of the benefits of a large space telescope, or something like that. The first written mention is in Martin's notebooks, in an entry dated July 22, 1954. And here it is in the next slide. There's some diagrams on the opposite page to show to re-image it. There's rails east-west carrying two aerials, e.g. 30 foot by 30 foot, cables in equal sections, etc., etc. And just to put this in context, you see the next entry, a week later, that if the new statistics results are right, that's what was going on that time. Well, there's been a long gap in the way of anything written, except that shortly before this, on the 22nd June 54, there's entry which says, highbrow computers, because of course the computing was a great difficulty of this idea. Preliminary analysis done at time of recording, for example, clock-driven sine potentiometer, fit and set to give appropriate number of revolutions each minute, say. So there was some sort of mechanical device for taking out some of the interferometer fringes. There are many other types of telescope considered, including a lunar occultation aerial, for example, and also a horrendous thing which is cylindrical paraboloid, which is supposed to go around on rails. And maybe, but then again, maybe not, that brought Martin's thoughts back to the biggest turntable of them all. At any rate, the next relevant entry is on in 1958. No. It's not until 15th of December 1959, in fact. Extension of idea proposed 22nd of July 1954. Two 30 foot to 40 foot paraboloids, rail east west with polar mounts, query electronic bandwidth control, etc., etc. There's more of this. 12-hour recording of 7.5 degree circle of sky. And then there's basic numerical estimates of things like signal to noise ratios, bandwidths, and beam widths, and so on. But clearly, the idea of supersynthesis was locally an accept what we call supersynthesis, Earth rotation synthesis, was locally a well-known concept. So here earlier, there's another entry, which I think is on the next slide, which just says, use of steerable words. These are the old German X-radar antennas that we had on the site, and which Graham Smith used in the early work. And there are various uses listed among the just supersynthesis. With no further explanation, so clearly it was in the air. Now, in the meantime, a research student from Sweden called Jan Hedborg had made an experimental test of Earth rotation synthesis. It was a very modest test. It involved two little aerials which he had used on his main project of mapping the sun, or rather locating bursts on the sun. And he saw just two sources, M87 and the Crab Nebula. It was a test of the principle, and the last chapter of his thesis contains what is probably the clearest account up to that time of the principles of Earth rotation synthesis. And here are two pages of the next slides. Here are the records he got, and here are cross sections of the map that he made, with the Crab Nebula here and much else. It was purely a test. It was very modest, produced no astronomy. And oddly enough, he preferred to use a north-south array, a north-south line, which made the geometry more complicated, which means that the theory he produced in species was not quite as simple as it might have been. And could I have the next line, please? But clearly, he understood what he was doing. And he also understood that other people had used Earth rotation before him. So he says, the periodicity of an interferometer recording is often used to determine the declination of a source, Smith 1952. And it was noted in the first Cambridge survey, Ryle Smith Nelson 1950, that it's possible to sort out some confused regions because sources of different declinations had different periodicities. McAdam, 1958, somewhere around, treated aerials as filters that relied essentially on the periodicity for his declination resolving power in a high declination survey. This can now be looked upon as the synthesis of extra aperture by the rotation of the Earth. Hendon's work must have been rather independent and rather private, because Martin Ryle now has very little recollection of the experiment. And conversely, if you read chapter 9 of Hendon's thesis, as I've recently done again, it sounds as though he invented the whole thing all by himself. And it's very difficult to think that in a closely knit group as ours was at the time, that he was not aware of what else was going on around him. So somehow it was a very private experiment. The next trial of Earth rotation, this was on a much bigger scale, and that was done by Martin Ryle and Dan Nibble in May 1960, and in an improved version in June 61. Here is the picture, the next slide. Looking at the tape. Well, I think this is one of the beautiful experiments done in radio astronomy, because they used this antenna system with the moving antenna just on the east-west line, this one, and this is not scale, more scale. And by introducing just one little aerial here and dividing this long bit into 32 elements and this into, how many was it? Eight, I think. Adding one element there, we're able to get all the spacings from 1 unit to 75 units and synthesize a map of the little region around the North Pole, which they could keep the whole thing pointing at all the time, of course. And they were thereby able to make a map of an 8-degree patch of sky around the North Pole with a 4.5 arc minute beam, which was an enormous advance. It enabled them to measure sources down to 250 millijanskias, which was 8 times more sensitive than the Corsi survey. And that is the biggest single step. I think there has been in sensitivity and in resolving power, probably until we come to the VLA, very much larger sort of investment that was involved here. So let's have a look at the map of the sky. On the next slide, please. Can't see it very well, these are lots of little sources. This was shown at a Testament II conference, about 1961 or 62. And those who were there say that they saw Professor Wilt looking at it very thoughtfully for a long time. I don't know whether that was the moment of decision, but somehow the Benelux cross certainly changed into the Westerbork synthesis telescope. Now, it would be quite wrong to suppose that these tests gave rise to the design of the 1 mile telescope. They were going on in parallel with the development of the 1 mile telescope. They were going on in parallel with the development of the 1 mile telescope. After the December 1959 laboratory notebook entry, one finds that immediately work begins in January of the following year, just a month later. Inquiries go out to about a dozen firms about construction of paraboloids, and equatorial maps for them. And then there is, about the same time, a provisional cost estimate, not in handwriting, adding up the 10% contingencies to £368,000. This went into the application to the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research in April 60. And in June, the DSIR produced a grant for a design study. And it chimes through the very cautious official letters that the DSIR really wanted this project to go ahead. But then, as things moved towards the construction stage, it became clear that it was going to be a lot more difficult. Everything had to go through official channels. For example, the Ministry of Works will have to be the sole channel for instruction firms employed. And by the spring of 1961, there were increasing frustrations, and Martin was getting very exasperated because he could see that there was no grant for the project as a whole yet, and so no tenders could go out, and was there going to be time to get the foundations in before winter came back? And one sees this very clearly in the correspondence that he's getting increasingly desperate. And then in the summer, in mid-July 61, it becomes clear why there seemed to be this official foot dragging, because there was a letter from the DSIR announcing that the grant for the radio telescope was going to be delayed. What had happened is that the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research hadn't got enough money to fund all the major projects it wanted to fund, and so, to be quite fair, it froze them all. So, by December of that year, this policy had been reversed. The project was funded, but by that time it had clearly been put back a year. Then we see the construction, the concreting over that year, and the laying foundations and so on. And there is where the rail track is going to be for the 1 mile telescope. It consists of three paraboloids, two fixed and one moving on rails, 1.5 miles long, very broad gauge rails. And we're looking along the place where the rails are. See, this is December 62. Next, please, we'll run through yourself quickly. A little bit of joining the rails together. Next, please. Here is construction work again. Next, please. Next, please. Here's the central laboratory and the base of the disc going up. I think that's April 63 now. Next, please. Anyway, that takes us to the complete 1 mile telescope. The first trial survey was made in the early summer of 64, that was never published. And then that was 408 megahertz, and then there were first observations at 28 centimeters of Cygnus and Cassiopeia, and we had the first proper maps of Cygnus and Cassiopeia. And although there were many later improvements, it was clear that it all worked. Now, that meant that one could then think about what to do with this system, this kind of system. By the end of 64, John Baldwin and John Krychoff had firm plans for another telescope to be put on the same rails for collisions with which they wanted to observe the hydrogen line. And that was built then very cheaply because we used the same rails. It obviously involved scheduling problems, but that is something one has to put up with. 2 years later, Martin Rowell was confident that the one-mile system worked more or less down to the theoretical limits, and was designing the next and larger system. And that was pretty well, the design of that was settled in outline by Mark 67, and was going to the 5 kilometer telescope, or 3 miles at that stage, because Britain hadn't gone metric yet. And certainly it incorporated some new techniques, and certainly there were some interesting bits of history connected with it, involving the closing of the Cambridge railway line, which made available a narrow strip of land running more or less east-west, and also the course of the M11 motorway, which went right through the middle of where the radio telescope was to be, and that gave rise to much negotiation and much anxiety, and even an examination question. The examination question being about the Fresnel diffraction over a metal fence past the motorway. How high would the metal fence have to be to prevent the interference from getting to a radio telescope going away? But the really significant change between the 1 mile telescope and its successor was, I think, not in the technology, but in the astronomical aims that were involved. The point was that the 1 mile telescope was still designed largely as a survey instrument. It was designed to extend the source counts to deeper and deeper levels. It was designed to show that these were isotropic of the sky. It was designed to do these things with pencil beams so that one had no worries about leaving out some of the sources because of large diameters. And by 1966, we really knew the answers, the basic answers to these questions. And what was wanted was something which looked in more detail at the internal structure of radio sources, individual sources. Because by that time, it was clear that piling up more evidence about source counts, the same kind which just showed the source counts were steep, was not going to convince anyone who was not convinced already. And what one wanted to do in the way of cosmology was to find out how the source counts changed in their world. And by that time, one also knew that the 1 mile had shown enough source structure to make the further investigation of the internal structure of sources a profitable pursuit, and we wanted to get to grips with the physics of radio sources. And so it was designed with quite different aims in view. So, for example, sensitivity was sacrificed and in favor of being able to operate at high frequencies. So smaller dishes were installed with the 1 mile, smaller dishes which however had a solid surface, and the ability to map a whole region of sky completely was also sacrificed. In the new telescope, the dishes could only be set down in particular places, so that one could not do a complete synthesis of a patch of sky. So that is the significant change at that stage. Now, there have been many further developments in astrophysical synthesis that have already gone past the 1960 limit, and I think this is also a good place to stop the story from my point of view, because up to this stage, the story is very largely the story of one man, Martin Ryle, who is retiring this year, so I think it is very appropriate that this particular talk would end at that point. It has nothing to do with astrophysics, and I found it in the record. Yes. This is a 1961 slide, and it's appropriate in one way, possibly, when I tell you who the people involved are. This is Professor Mott, Lady Mott. This is King Paul and Queen Frederica of Greece. And it seems that Queen Frederica, at that time, wanted to find out what's been happening in astronomy. So they came to Cambridge, and the thing which had great interest to astronomers
He shows a slide of Hoyle and Robert